Hadi bakalım. Hadi bakalım. Hadi bakalım.
Trump has resisted Bibi's demand to start a war with Iran, and in fact, going the other way entirely and seeking out a peace deal with Tehran. Also, Tulsi threw the gun owners a bone and released documents from the Biden era detailing their efforts to end the Second Amendment.
Good news on all fronts, and I'm glad to hear it.
All good news.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us again today for another episode of Human Reaction. We are glad to be here with you. I've got David Rand over here. Just you and me, buddy. Just flying solo.
Intimate, if
dual,
you will.
Dual solo.
just cuddling up to talk about the news.
That's right. That's right. While you're here, and before we get started, if you're on YouTube, please hit the like button and subscribe. Hit the notification bell so you don't miss an episode coming out every week, sometimes twice a week. We're doing our best to get two episodes out per week. Sometimes we can make it happen. Sometimes we can't. This guy's always in Helena doing stuff. We've all got stuff going on. And if you're on Spotify or anywhere else, please do subscribe, follow the channel, the show, and make sure to leave us a review. That really helps the algorithm for us.
This episode is brought to you by Revved Up Promo, the official apparel partner of Human Reaction. Revved Up is a premier full-service shop specializing in laser engraving, screen printing, and embroidery. Not only are they now making all of our apparel right down the road from us, they can do the same for your brand and ship it to you anywhere in the world. Revved Up helps you navigate the extensive universe of merch options and uses state-of-the-art techniques to showcase your brand in its very best light. So if you want to support our show and our generous sponsor, you can now do so by buying our merch and by turning to Revved Up Promo for your own custom apparel needs. Reach them at revveduppromo.com, that's with two V's and two P's, or just check the show notes for a link.
Let's get right into it. So what was going on with regard to this conversation, this debate between Trump and Bibi over an attack on Iran?
So the New York Times put out this article. Trump waved off Israeli strike after visions emerged in his administration. And this is kind of, it's kind of sitting in the thread of what happened with Signalgate, right? Where you have this inter-dialogue happening. I mean, the most interesting part of Signalgate, beyond whoopsies, here's an Atlantic reporter in a Signal chat group, in the boys chat, you know, is this question of, like, you know, he kind of campaigns like Ron Paul, we get John McCain every time, right? Mm-hmm. It just seems like this, from the libertarian perspective, everyone always is us when they're running, and then when they actually are in the administration, they do the opposite. But what we have here is this interdynamic that's happening within the cabinet of debates between people. You have the realist camp and you have the neocons, and with Trump in the middle, kind of just being Trump. You know what I mean? We got some degree of resolution here of, like, texture really of what these conversations have been happening. And, you know, the big takeaway was that, since late last year till May, or until now, there's been a plan. The Israelis have been pitching for the administration to engage in a strike in Iran, like a substantial one, including commandos.
Right.
Airstrike. Not just like before where they're shooting rockets. We're talking about aerial combat and, like, controlling the skies over Iran and, like, a ground force, not mass invasion, but strike invasion.
Now, Is the plan, was Bibi's plan for them to be Israeli commandos just with the support of the U.S. and sort of, you know, airstrikes and things to kind of help them? Or did they want U.S. boots on the ground here?
Yeah. So the plan was originally set for last October, got bumped out to May because they didn't have everything together. So this was actually a plan they were cutting with the prior administration. And then now they're going to basically say, no, we're not going to do it. So that's important detail, right?
For sure.
Biden wasn't saying no, and Trump was.
Yeah, which is good. So, I mean, that does substantiate what you were just saying, that maybe there's elements within the administration, at least, that are swaying Trump to be a little bit more non-interventionist on this issue.
Yeah, well, I mean, realist would probably be more accurate.
Sure.
But we can unpack those terms real quick in a minute. But to your question, we're talking a commando raid on the underground, like, infrastructure for the uranium enrichment program that they currently have. That is interesting because the uranium enrichment program is the one we gave them. But, you know, hold that aside just for a minute, or we'll return to it. And, you know, it's for power. It's for their nuclear power plants that they desire to have and for their defense, right? They have an enrichment program so that if a war did break out, they could create a nuclear weapon and therefore guarantee their security far better than if they didn't, especially given the fact that Israel has nukes, right?
Yeah.
So this commando raid is a whole different thing than what we've seen before. What we've seen before is long-range rockets being fired at one another. How much U.S. support? Well, I mean, it isn't clear, but it's at minimum U.S. targeting support, air support, and naval support. That is a substantial, you know, question. And then once that happens, this is already a clear doctrine from the Iranians that all the U.S. troops in the Middle East are now, you know,
risk.
Active combatants.
Right.
On the side of Israel, that, right. You know, from their military doctrine. So that means our troops in Syria and Iraq and Kuwait and all over the Middle East are going to get bombed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yikes. So.
Also anti-Israel, anti-air support and the actual weapons themselves are ours, including a 30,000-pound bunker-busting bomb. Some of these are our aircraft. We don't know if the over aircraft that are actually dropping the bombs are ours or not, but these could be supporting aircraft. If, say, for example, a dogfight breaks out over Iraq, we would be participating in that.
Right? Yikes.
Air defense system. So what Israel wants is to be able to hit them without being hit, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we actually have already moved Patriot and THAAD systems over into the Middle East specifically to defend Israel from Iranian attacks already.
Yeah.
So it would be using those and then, you know, perhaps our B-2 bombers to ensure the success of this whole thing and defend against the retaliation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I want to circle back to the thing you said we'd put aside for a second. Why does Iran have a nuclear program?
Well, it's Groundhog Day again. And, you know, we're overthrowing elections in Eastern Europe. We're really pissed off about Iran having a nuclear program. But we never asked the question, why does Iran have a nuclear program? You know, Iraq didn't have one. Saudi Arabia doesn't have one. What is Iran? Well, Eisenhower in 1953 started a program called the Atoms for Peace program, basically saying that the U.S. will provide nuclear infrastructure for power to all these smaller third world countries that are allies of ours. And at the time, the Shah, who is the military monarch dictator of Iran, we were buddy-buddy with him. And he was cool with British Petroleum taking oil out of the ground and shipping it to Europe at the rates that they wanted. Well, that program, you know, it culminated in the 1960s with us actually having hosting 50 students at MIT in the 1970s to train them to be nuclear engineers and then send them back to Iran. So all of this, as usual, is our fault, right? We nuclearized Iran for, you know, and then there's a big difference between, you know, the grade that you do at like 3% enrichment to, you know, a percentage that you use for, you know, boiling water so that you can create energy.
Yeah.
And what you use for dropping a nuclear bomb, which is a much higher enrichment rate.
Right.
So the goal was always for a peaceful program to like give people nuclear technology by training them up for it. And then, you know, but the problem is the short-sightedness of like, well, the Shah will always be there, right? And then when they threw him out, we put him back in, you know, because they threatened British Petroleum with nationalizing it.
So clarify that for me. The Iranians threw him out?
Yeah. Okay. So what happens is there is a democratic, you know, takeover of sorts, where the Iranian people elected a guy to be prime minister who then wanted to nationalize British Petroleum oil infrastructure. And of course, in the background of that is the nuclear program. Mm-hmm. And what's going on there.
And was that Mohammad Mossadegh?
Right.
Okay.
And then we sponsored a coup to overthrow them. And then they then couped us back and then put in the Ayatollah. And that the religious dictatorship, and the religious dictatorship now has controlled them ever since, including the hostage scandal and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
So we taught them to fish, so to speak, without looking down the road, thinking that maybe at some point they'd use that fish to slap someone in the face.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah.
Great.
And specifically in this, too, you have to understand our relationships with Israel has changed substantially over that time, too. I mean, 1950s, 60s, and 70s, we didn't have the kind of relationship we had since the 80s, you know, with Israel. It's just different.
Yeah.
And that and the difference there was that they were an ally, but they were also very close to the Soviet Union in many ways. I mean, they have a whole kibbutz system. They have like little socialist communes everywhere, right? They were treading the middle water for there for a while before they really became tight with America's in the 1980s.
Interesting. Israel was tight with the Soviet Union.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Huh. Yeah. In the beginning, in the founding of Israel and all that kind of stuff. And you got to understand it too. I mean, like they're a combination. There was a lot of bleed over between the Bolsheviks and the Zionists, and those kind of groups ran in very similar circles. So socialism was a big part of the founding of Israel, 100%.
Interesting.
Yeah, but obviously it was a little more democratic socialism, right? It was less authoritarian than the Soviets. But they kind of played both sides for a while there before they settled with, you know, the American side. And this is a very low resolution picture. There's a lot of detail that we're skipping over here. So go check that out. But you know, this whole thing comes together with the Obama nuclear deal, right? So it's from the 1980s to the the Obama administration, every couple of years, including, I remember riding in a car with my dad and listening to Rush Limbaugh, and they're saying 3 months, 1 year, 8 months, you know,
until Iran attacks Israel with a nuke.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Until they develop a nuclear weapon and how disastrous that will be.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, with after 9/11, those really kicked up even more, right? Sure. After 9/11, there's really a lot of argument about radical Islam within the United States and how you can't really deal with radical Islam because they all want to die anyway. So that sort of argument, right? They all want to be martyrs. So therefore you can't, if they get a nuclear weapon, you can't, you know, MAD does not apply. Mutually assured destruction does not apply to
them. Right. They don't care if they get attacked.
Right. So that's like you got to understand the cultural moment of that era of the Bush administration.
Yeah.
Obama comes in, second term, he cuts the Iranian nuclear deal, which says we're going to have inspections. This is interesting from Kyle's big theory from two podcasts ago about, you know, Trump's perspective on the Iranian nuclear deal might have had less to do with Iran, more to do with France's role in it and providing them uranium. But when Trump comes in, he pulls us out of the Iranian nuclear deal.
Why did he do that?
Well, he says because it's a bad deal. But it's never been clear to me exactly why he says that. It's just that he says
that. Like what about it is bad?
Yeah, yeah. It's just bad. It's not good.
Okay.
You know.
Sounds Trumpian.
So that gives a fertile ground for the whole, well, it was really about Europe, or it was really about pressure from the Israelis, because they didn't like the deal, right? They want a very specific strategy, which is the Libyan strategy, which is to get them to completely denuclearize and then overthrow them.
Right.
Right. And don't get me wrong, the Iranians are not they're not an innocent actor. They have their own government that is an abuse of the people who live there, and they sponsor terrorism and stuff like that, a strategy that has not worked out well for the Middle East. But they're...
When you say that, what do you mean? Israel sponsors terrorism.
No, Iran does.
Oh, I got you. Okay,
yeah, sorry. So Iran does. Israel did. They were the first terrorist bombers in the Middle East. I mean, the King David Hotel and stuff like that. But the, you know, the use of terrorism and all the different factions across the Middle East, whether it's, you know, the Iranians backing Shia militias in Iraq to attack us, or their support of Hezbollah, has long been a problem, right? Mm-hmm. And how to navigate that problem.
Yeah.
Obviously, now they have an alliance with the Houthis, who have a Shia population. They're not strictly Shia, but they have some Shia populations. So the Sunni-Shia battle there is happening. Iran is really ticked off. Iran, of course, loves the United States government overthrowing Iraq, right? Because that was a dictatorship of a Sunni over a bunch of Shias.
Mm-hmm.
Sunnis have the connection with Saudi Arabia. So Saudis are also upset because now the Shias, they themselves get, you know, more potential gains in the middle of the Middle East, right?
Yeah.
In Iraq, now they're ruled by, you know, coalition governments that include a very substantial amount of Shia presence. And they're not taking orders directly from Saudi Arabia or the United States, right? Mm-hmm. Although they are a client state of sorts. The Saudis are pissed off about that whole situation. We're allies with the Saudis for all kinds of reasons. They go all the way back to the 90s. And, you know, Obama comes in and he says, well, we're going to have this nuclear deal. The nuclear deal then results in this Saudis back. Well, you got to give us something right here because, like, you know, you're not ending the nuclear program. You're not really removing the Iranian variable from the equation. You're just kind of creating a new status quo. Mm-hmm. So support us in Yemen. And so Obama supports them in Yemen, and then we get involved in Yemen, and that's that. Then that war, whole thing goes.
And we're still fighting there, yes. As it turns out.
Yes, and doing the Saudis and the Europeans bidding in Yemen. So he withdraws from the nuclear deal. That kind of creates a new status quo of sanctions. A big part of the nuclear deal that everyone's pissed off about is that when they overthrew the Shah, we used the same tariff and sanctions power in the Cold War that we gave the president that everyone's pissed off about now. We used that power back then to freeze all their assets overseas. And that is the money that they gave back to the Iranians because it was theirs.
During the Biden administration?
Yeah, as part of the nuclear deal.
Gotcha.
So when you hear someone say, well, Obama gave them all this money, that wasn't your money. That was their money we took from them and then we're giving back to them.
Right.
Yeah, right.
It's like a tax refund.
You could call it that.
Happy tax day, by the way, everybody.
Yeah. So the what this means is, and obviously, you know, you could visualize this as, you know, an effort to get to stability going to peace, right? About cutting a deal to get to stability.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a substantial amount of pushback on this whole thing. And that, of course, that's the framework, that's the background for this whole debate that happened within the administration.
Yeah. So what does this tell us about, like, the entities within the administration? Who is more hawkish? Who is less?
Yeah,
hawkish?
So it won't surprise anyone if you watched our coverage over the nomination process. What it came down to was one of the generals, Michael Kurilla, and then, of course, the Michael Walls,
National Security Advisor.
Mm-hmm. And then you got the other side of it was Tulsi Gabbard, J.D. Vance, and Susie Wiles, who warned of the larger conflict and, like, the problem of this becoming a bigger conflict.
Right. So, and I think it was Tulsi, right, that said even just moving American forces into position in the area could escalate tensions and cause something here that may be inadvertent.
Mm-hmm. Right. And just like you mobilize on the border.
Yeah.
And we have a lot of bases all around Iran.
Yeah.
So
like putting missiles in Ukraine or whatever.
Yes. Yes. I mean, and remember in Ukraine, the last, you know, diplomatic moment we had was an American, and we have this cable now because of reporting, was an American person on the ground saying, one of our agents, one of our folks that were moving weapons into Ukraine saying, we're probably overdoing this. We're probably actually going to cause a conflict because we're not right-sizing the amount of weapons we're giving.
Mm-hmm.
So when you think about moving all the anti-air, when you think about mobilizing and getting ready to be able to fight a air battle, those sorts of things, would they have intelligence services too. They are also monitors. They have satellites as well. So they're going to be looking at what we're doing, and that could actually kick things off.
Mm-hmm.
J.D. Vance's position was, we need to make sure we should delay this. We should cut a deal, and if the deal falls apart, because then once we've started fighting, we lose all of our leverage.
Right,
because it's the same position we're in Russia right now, where things, peace has been a lot slower. It didn't happen today. Well, why? Because the fighting's already happening. You could just say, we're going to fight you more. Well, in this case, in Ukraine's case, Russia has a much bigger population. They stand to lose less, even if we give more weapons and things like that, because
mm-hmm.
we're not going to send the 82nd Airborne.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, is very similar in the sense that Iran has a lot of assets there when our assets are spread all over the globe.
Right.
And we don't want a direct confrontation with them because that would be costly and take a long time and it would be disastrous for our blood and treasure.
Yeah.
So, you know, Vance's position was, well, we're losing our best card if we play that up front. What we should do is cut the deal. And then if the deal falls apart, then we have that card.
Yeah.
So, and then Hegseth, he actually had technical disagreements with the viability of the Israeli plan. And, you know, just to what degree U.S. assistance would actually take them over the top and actually get them to what they want to go to. But at the end of the day, how does this not result in a regime change war? Right. Because if you take all their nuclear facilities, then you have to kill all of their nuclear scientists. Otherwise, they just start doing it again.
Yeah.
And then you're going to fight it again? If we're just looking at another forever war here.
Right. Well, that's kind of the point of the deep state, right? I mean, that's what they would want, is a regime change war and something that drags out forever and ever so that the military industrial complex makes billions of dollars selling weapons.
Yes. Well, you have that perverse incentive. And you just, you know, there's also the mythos around this, right? And that's where Marco Rubio is at. It's like, you can't cut a deal with Iran, you know, maximum pressure is the only thing that's ever worked. We should just continue the maximum pressure campaign. And, you know, military assistance to Israel. Right. So Rubio said exactly what we were worried he would be in the administration.
Yeah.
And then Waltz was, of course, he was just whatever Israel wants. And then Dubowitz was another variable in here. And he's the CEO Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Dubowitz lobbied for the military strikes over diplomacy and just basically say, well, they're just doing Obama over again, that sort of argument.
Yeah. So kind of the way it's stacking up is we've got Michael Waltz, Marco Rubio, Dubowitz, and General Kirilla on the hawkish side. And then we've got Tulsi Gabbard, Pete Hegseth to an extent, more on technical grounds, J.D. Vance.
And Tulsi.
And I already said Tulsi. Oh. So we've got four for it and three against it.
Yeah.
Essentially. Yeah. And then Trump's in the middle trying to decide based on all of this feedback and input.
Mm-hmm. And this is a dynamic that is not far from where JFK was at when it came to the Cold War. He had both, you know, people that were really close to him that were skeptical, but then he had all these generals that are all opposed. And that dynamic is invoking to me.
Yeah.
When you read about the kind of dialogue that happened in the JFK administration around these decisions, you get this sense that, you know, he's kind of a lone person in this, and having people around to back you up can really help that decision-making process actually be adversarial. So you kind of hope that that's the position he's taken. I think if you look at like Kyle's theory on Trump is that he's a he just wants to build cool shit and have a good time, and war doesn't do that, right?
Yeah.
So he has a natural inclination against. But we've seen, you know, previously that he's been persuaded to engage in strikes and things like that based upon the recommendation of the generals and the people around him.
Yeah. Yeah. Certainly persuadable.
Yeah.
But in this case, it seems like he's sided with what appears to be the minority of voices saying we need to exercise some caution here and try to make a deal first. And maybe that's why. I mean, he is the art of the deal guy. So maybe he's inclined to go there first. And I think that does make sense. If you just think about it, it's like, why rush into war that's going to cost a bunch of lives and a bunch of money and cause chaos in the world when you can hopefully find a peaceful resolution?
Yeah, exactly. And that also explains his bellicoseness alongside of this, right? So at the same time that Witkoff is the guy who's going to be cutting this deal. Remember, Witkoff's the same guy from the Hamas deal, really on the first day of the administration, before the administration even started, and has been negotiating the Russian deal. He's now doing the Iranian deal too. Right? So this is Trump's best buddy, goes back 50 years, you know, real estate developer. And every article you'll find in like the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times that mentioned this always has to mention he has no diplomatic experience. You know,
yes.
And so that every time that happens, it kicks off this big debate. Like, well, yeah, but neither. So Anthony Blinken did, and what did he do in 4 years?
Yeah.
Nothing.
Well, yeah, it's really just a credentialism debate, isn't it?
Right. Yeah, exactly. The credential debate extends.
It does.
So the policy process, you know, looks like Trump is really trusting Witkoff to try to pull something off here. And doing that while he is, you know, saying, Iran, you, the Houthis are you. Like, every time they strike, we know it's really your weapons. That logic obviously applies in the other direction, too. Every time Israel strikes Iran or anybody else,
don't look at that
weapons.
Don't look at that.
Right?
That's fine.
So it's like the egoism of like a toddler. And I'm not saying Trump. I just mean that's like the nature of the state, is to have the egoism of a toddler. Yeah. Where like you can't possibly put yourself in anyone else's shoes. You're so in your emotion and in your perspective, you can't.
Yeah.
You don't have the maturity to be like, well, we're kind of a participant.
You're in always this wrong. I'm always right. That's just the way the world works. Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay. So Trump didn't want to make this deal over the phone, right? So Bibi comes to the U.S. Under the auspices of negotiating tariffs, but they end up talking about this deal. What transpires at that point?
Well, it looks like that Bibi walked away disappointed, right? That they really wanted a May strike and he didn't get it. So it does appear, if and there was some breaking points, had a really good breakdown of this, that the Israel lobby and people connected around the Israel lobby are, they're kind of freaking out. They're attacking Witkoff directly. They're saying they're doing the credentialism thing with him. They're saying he's not experienced. He doesn't know what he's doing. And they're advocating openly for, like, Bibi's advocating open for a, quote, Libya-style agreement. Now, circling on that, because we mentioned up front.
Mm-hmm.
Libya gave up their nuclear weapons. And interesting, you know, little tidbit from the Tucker Carlson thing was trying to organize, like, an African Union with its own monetary policy.
Right.
Gold-backed,
right? Not dollar-denominated.
Supposedly gold-backed. You know, it's funny. This has been a rumor for a long time. And that he had on, I forget his name, he was a intelligence committee chair that got ousted after he questioned the 9/11 narrative.
Oh, yes. He was just on there. Kurt Weldon, I
believe. Yeah.
Yeah.
So he claims that he was directly involved with the things that led up to that. And then we know the end of the story. Arab Spring happens, diplomacy 2.0. And this is the thing, there's an interesting phenomena with this and a couple other things that are happening right now when pro hawks are talking about the agency of the people on the ground, where they de-emphasize everything we've learned about the censorship industrial complex's bridge from the Arab Spring to actively censoring Brexit and the Trump administration and elections in Indonesia and all over the world. That there was a capability built during the Arab Spring to encourage these uprisings. This is detailed really well in Surveillance Valley. It's a great book. Huge black pill. Huge black pill. Yeah. Like everywhere you're looking, like, oh my God, Tor Network was developed by the Navy intelligence. Ah, you know, like there's just so much there.
Yep.
But these tactics were developed at this time that the local agency hawk crowd de-emphasized to say, well, these are all just organic uprisings. These couldn't possibly be real things. They couldn't possibly, you can't blame America for the people on the ground in Libya standing up to their dictator and killing them. But we do know that it was and now we know, we didn't know this at the time. In fact, at the time, I was largely like, wow, this is awesome. Look how cool the internet is, you know. And
totally.
Get rid of Mubarak.
I was glued to Twitter at the time.
Like, yeah.
My entire feed was filled with videos and photos from Egypt of these people rising up, and it seemed really authentic.
Yeah.
And I didn't know any better.
Yeah.
I had no idea the censorship industrial complex existed or what it was doing at the time.
Nobody did, right? And it wasn't even censoring at this time. It was boosting.
Yeah.
It was taking those voices and making them louder, giving them technical assistance on coordinating what they're doing, and probably give them USA dollars to like finance this whole operation. So is that an enough American imprint for America to take responsibility for their ending result? Well, we know that they had plans to do this, right? The when we talk about the Clean Break memo, go talk to Dave Smith about that. He's the expert.
Uncredentialed expert.
But, you know, those sorts of arguments about Project from a New American Century and how to reshape the Middle East for sustainable peace using America's global hegemony in order to create the thing that we're going for here.
Overthrowing 7 countries in 5 years.
Yeah. That's a Clean Break memo. But yeah, exactly. Yes. Exactly. So those sorts of things were ambitions of the State Department, and then they all happened, right? So, you know, it's obviously like a cracked open door that they opened wider with investment and operations, but it was definitely something that we opened.
Yeah.
So this whole argument boils down to, and the reason why the Libya-style agreement is such a terrible way to go about doing this, and obviously a way to spike the negotiation, is because where does the negotiation start? Does it start with, you, Iran, must get rid of all your nuclear program forever, like they did in Libya, and completely denuclearize, even though we gave you that capability?
And that includes power.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. I mean, no, none of that.
So basically destroy your energy infrastructure.
Yes.
And make your country poor.
Yeah. Either you do that, you know, put in dams. Maybe we'll help you. We'll build some coal-fired power plants and some nuclear.
That's not very green at all, is it? I'll put in some solar panels and some wind farms for you.
Yeah. More variable energy. You know, those sorts of questions, that whole push for a Libya-style agreement spikes everything, because what happened in Libya? Well, they gave it up. Arab Spring happened, and we've financed various different color revolutions all over the world, including Iran. So Iran looks at that and say, well, you've done, you know, 15 of these color revolutions all over the world. And then you ask Libya to give up the nuclear weapons. And then that guy got sodomized to death.
With a sword.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, no.
That's pretty much a non-starting negotiation.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. And that's where Israel wants the negotiation to start. And they didn't start there. So there was a huge blowback. Today, this morning, there was a Wall Street Journal article that indicated that he's kind of walking that back, being a little bit sharper on where exactly the enrichment thing is. But they didn't walk back the crucial part.
Who's walking it back?
Witkoff. Okay. Witkoff did. With some public statements that were more bellicose in just how firm they want to be in the inspections and in the enrichment question. So it's not that they're not engaged or like serious about the enrichment question. It's just that they're not starting out with where Israel wants to start out. So There's been all this pushback and reminders, it was, who was the other guy? It was Adam Boehlner was a special envoy, presidential envoy to help Steve Witkoff specifically with the Hamas hostage negotiation deal. And he got ousted after a couple comments he made that were just a little too friendly to Hamas, right? And not differential enough for Israel. And these are some of the statements. Quote, "We're the United States. We're not an agent of Israel. We have specific interests at play."
Wow.
Basically, can't just say that.
We're our own country. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
That's not going to play.
And effectively, he was operating on special envoy. He was going for a special presidential cabinet position, and he withdrew his nomination after all the blowback from that. The other quote was, Ron Dermer in this case, has someone that he doesn't know well making direct contact with Hamas. Maybe I would like to see them and say, look, they don't have horns growing out of their head. They're actually guys like us. They're pretty nice guys, talking about Hamas. So you can't say that either. Like, this guy really stepped in it from the you can't say that because of our relationship with Israel type stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I saying Hamas are pretty nice guys. That's just kind of, that's a bit of a non-starter.
Yeah. Well, and it is for, you know, some sensible reasons, right? I mean, these guys did October 7th.
Yeah, kind of exactly. Stuff,
right? The pain of that is real for a lot of people.
Absolutely. For sure.
But also, you can't negotiate with the devil.
True.
Right. And if you want to negotiate, you got to give them the charity of being human beings.
Right.
The temptation of war and the temptation of statism itself is always to put the other group as something subhuman, right? And Israel kind of engages in this quite a bit. In fact, a lot of the ICC court genocide court case relies on Israeli statements that dehumanize Palestinians, not just Hamas, but Palestinians. But they're the power. They're the person with the hostages. You have to negotiate with the guy, with the coked out guy that's got the hostages inside the house with a gun to their head. What else do you do?
You got to send some pizzas in.
Yeah. You got to figure out. You got to get aid in that case. The analogy there, and you have to figure out how to actually de-escalate this cycle of violence that you're in.
We need to get that guy who was all over Masterclass. Oh, what's it? Chris Voss.
Okay.
He wrote like negotiating like your life depends on or something like that. I forget the name of the book. I totally space it. But he's got some wisdom on this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Well, you have to create an actual connection between the negotiator and the person who is.
Right. I think he calls it tactical empathy.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And that isn't possible as long as you are really seeking justice more so than peace.
Right.
Right. Because if you're more outraged about the things that happened that were terrible and bad, than you are about a pursuit of a sustainable peace going forward, then, you know, it's not going to happen.
Right.
And that's the other part of it too. Like, Israel really doesn't like the United States directly interfacing with Hamas, right? Because, you know, we might prioritize the Americans that are hostages first. And that's an understandable problem from their point of view. But you also, you know, might humanize them. You might, you know, settle down and put pressure on to do something that's more leaning towards peace than justice.
Right. Does Israel really want peace with Hamas?
Well, I think there are, I think, factions within Israel that are legitimately, you know, looking at the fact that Hamas fighters have not gone away. There was some reporting this week from the Wall Street Journal that suggests that the Hamas is struggling to actually pay their combatants. But when you're in that situation, it's hard to imagine. You know, the terrorist math problem is such a tractable problem.
Yeah.
Right? And even if you, like, Dave Smith was debating a guy who was, like, a expert on military law and history of laws of war and stuff like that, and that we talked about in the podcast that released today, Friday, and this will probably come out on Saturday or Sunday. With that, you know, he's saying, well, you're acting like this is like urban warfare and not a regime change operation. That little quote's really insightful, right? Because the challenge of that is, well, it is urban warfare. You're gonna have an urban area. Well, it was an urban area. Now it's rubble. But and you have a group that every time you bomb them, an ethnic identity that then says, well, that created 5 more terrorists out of the 3 you just killed. So how do you handle that? How do you deal with that? Do you got to kill them all? Like, how do you eventually come to terms with that? Well, in Iraq, we kind of got to deal with them. We went to the Shiite militias and we said, hey, we're going to be getting out of here. You know, you're going to take this area. You're going to take this area. And, you know, we sought peace over justice because we just got too tired to do anything else.
And too poor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you got to wonder when Israel gets there. You know, it has to be, there's some load point. There's some like swing point. There's some outer frontier where you have enough people that are like, I don't care. I want to get back to normal. And are they there? Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
But there are definitely factions that will never get there, that they will pursue this forever.
Yeah.
If they have to, because they are so outraged by October 7th. They're so outraged by what they feel like is their divine right to the territory, and other motivations that, you know, are not conducive to prioritizing peace. So.
Well, I'm glad that Trump has made this decision, you know, on behalf of American interests, it seems, yeah, for now. And hopefully he can stand up to the wave of criticism and mean tweets that are headed their way at this point.
Yeah.
What do you see as the outcome of this, or the next steps coming from this?
Well, I think there's, well, so tomorrow, of the day we're recording, there's going to be another meeting in Rome with Witkoff and the administration of Iran. And if they can, you know, keep the progress going, you know, you have a chance. But the degree on the other side is the degree to which Iran will prioritize peace in Gaza as a contingent for this program.
Yeah.
The real great thing about the Obama deal was that Gaza was low level enough. I mean, there was fighting in 2014, for example, and things like that. But the fighting was low level enough that it wasn't as contentious of an issue and a priority for them, where the Iranians will lose face if they don't get something out of that from the American Israeli side.
Yeah. So that's where the art of the deal comes in. How do both sides walk away feeling like they won something?
Yeah, exactly.
And is there the willingness to do that on both sides?
Right. And Iran has the pressure too, bottom up, you know, to get rid of the sanctions, because, you know, they're not doing well either with being cut off from the world.
For sure.
Yeah. So we'll see. There's all, I'm not brave enough to predict, but I am brave enough to talk about it.
Dubiously speculate.
Yeah. So the other story from this week, we don't cover enough Second Amendment stuff. We do a lot of First Amendment stuff because I'm particularly passionate about it, and I do care about the Second Amendment.
You know what we never talk about is the Third Amendment.
Right?
No one ever talks about the Third Amendment.
What is the Third Amendment?
Pretty sure it's can't be obligated to quarter enemy soldiers. I forget. I haven't read the Bill of Rights in too long.
So the first story from Gun Owners of America was this tweet. Thank you, Pam Bondi and U.S. Ed Martin, from taking control away from rogue DOJ bureaucrats and withdrawing this Biden-era gun control charge. So this is the Toronto case. And, you know, amongst a list of different charges against this guy, and he did do something bad. He armed up and he drove to Obama's house and then got confronted by his security and then ran away. Bad. But one of the charges was that he had a pistol with a brace on it.
Right.
And if you remember, the ATF had judged that that is a rifle, a short-barreled rifle, and therefore the National Firearms Act of 1934 applied to it, and it had to have the extra stamp and the charge, and you couldn't deal it unless you had a the correct license to be able to possess it. So they removed that from one of the charges after GOA complained about it to the Biden administration. They didn't. They're like, yeah, go kick rocks. And then the Trump administration took away that one. He's still going to get the other charges. This is an example of like a peaceful gun owner just owning a gun and getting in trouble. This guy got in trouble for other reasons.
For sure.
But it is an important standard because it's this weird Schrodinger's cat thing. You know, like the cat is alive and dead in the box at the same time. It is both a pistol and a rifle at the same time if you attach the right part to it.
Yeah.
So that's an encouraging step. And the gun owners have, and the gun constituency from the right have really not gotten anything out of this so far, right? They've been getting the trans sports people have been getting wins left and right, right? The campus speech people, this complicated story. Who else? The Trump administration has been very conducive to, I think, the pro-Israel folks on the right.
I would say. Did pro-gun people donate $100 million to Trump's campaign, though, is the question.
Well, they did some work for him. Yeah,
100%. Some work.
You know, some independent expenditures on behalf of Trump. And because, you know, that's a clear calculus if you're a gun guy, right?
I mean, oh, yeah.
And the next story really demonstrates that even better. So the Tulsi Gabbard released this from the Biden administration's secret plan to eliminate the Second Amendment in the name of counterterrorism. And this is an interesting bit here. So Pillar 4, confront long-term contributions to domestic terrorism, and Action 411A, rein in the proliferation of ghost guns. Those are guns printed using plastic, PLA.
3D printed guns, right?
3D printer, yeah.
Which are not detectable in traditional metal detectors and stuff. Hence,
yeah, usually they'll have metal components to them, but they're far smaller.
That's fair. Yeah. But ghost guns, because they're not like licensed, they're not serialized, yes. They're invisible to the system.
Yeah, right. In fact, the Mangione case was with a ghost gun.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah. Encourage state adoptions of extreme risk protection orders. That means that means red flag laws?
Gun control of some kind?
Yeah. And drive executive and legislative action. So this means the federal government encouraging state governments to the next part, including banning assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. Yeah. So the Obama administration had a secret plan to use domestic terrorism as an argument for cracking down on the Second Amendment. And this was really so interesting.
Yeah. Good insight into the thinking of the Biden administration. Obviously not terribly surprising to me.
What are you talking about? Biden was a huge supporter of the Second Amendment. Just go out your front door with a shotgun, two blasts, bam, bam. That's a real quote. He really said that to humans as a serious senator.
But he also said a lot of other crazy, stupid shit. Anyway.
Right.
Yeah. So Tulsi releasing this, the significance is, okay, now we have some insight into this. What has been the response to this release, and what's the significance there?
Well, it's pretty fresh. I mean, it only came out yesterday. And, you know, obviously, it's not surprising, right? But there's always that lingering, because the Democrats really de-emphasized the Second Amendment concerns from their side, like the gun grabbers really lost a lot of clout. It just wasn't as big of a focus in many ways.
Yeah.
I can't tell you why, really. Yeah. But it just wasn't. I mean, like the Obama administration, they had their stuff on that, but it wasn't super strong. They would come out anytime there was a shooting and claim they needed to do something. But it was up to Congress to act. After the 1994... assault weapons ban. I don't like the word assault weapon. It's not very descriptive.
Doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, but semi-automatic rifle ban. Sure. When that in high-capacity magazines, and that's more of a state policy law for the most part, those sorts of actions by state legislatures are probably easier to do in Democrat states than they are to get by Congress, where you got to get by 60 votes in the Senate. So, you know, this is one bad because this shows a Department of Homeland Security effort to encourage state legislatures to do things, and that's bad. Like the federal government shouldn't be engaging in that.
Mm-hmm.
And two, it's also bad from the point of view of like, look, I mean, we as Second Amendment supporters are sometimes put in the role of like the like a conspiracy theorist. Like the right, the left wing is trying to emphasize that they don't care about this issue anymore, but they're like, I think you really do. I think at the you're just not talking about it, but you're still on the other side.
Oh, for sure.
And keeps the defenses up, right? And I think that's an important role for the culture, for the support of one of the most important American institutions, the First Amendment and the Second Amendment.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Because you can't have the first without the second.
That's right. And I think that's the biggest misunderstanding on the left is, oh, well, why do you need a high-capacity magazine to go shoot deer? It's like, well, that's not the point.
Also, don't tell me my happiness.
Right? Maybe don't tell me what I need.
I'm a man. You don't tell me what I need. I decide what I need.
I need a Toyota Hilux with a 50 cal in the back. And I'm not backing down
anything
on that.
Anything less than that is slavery. God Which, damn it.
By the way, total tangent. But it came out last week. There were rumblings that it seems like the Toyota Hilux might be coming to the U.S.
You are so pumped for that.
I'm so fucking
stoked. It is a really cool rig. I totally agree.
It's sick. I mean, a light diesel truck like just incredible. Indestructible. I would love it. I think Trump said something about like, you know, young men in America need, you know, to be able to buy a truck for $10,000 to $20,000. I'm like, yes.
Yes.
Yes. I'll take two.
I think the import tariffs might be a problem for that, bro, my man.
I mean, he's carving out exemptions right and left. So I'm hoping
just for the Toyota.
I'm hoping the Hilux lobby has some people in Washington.
I don't know if the UAW are going to put up with that.
Maybe if Toyota opens a plant in the U.S. to produce the Hilux domestically, maybe we're there.
Mm. With a diesel engine, though?
Yeah. Let's go.
That's going to happen, brother.
Let's go.
I hate to be your to knock down your parade.
That's all right. I need a little good resistance here.
Because I don't want you to get your hopes up too high.
Look. I've been waiting for this truck since I learned it existed, maybe 10 years ago, watching Top Gear, where they buried one in the sand on the beach, like in the surf, and
really?
Then dug it out. Well, they were driving them on the beach. It got buried by the surf.
Uh-huh.
They dug it out, fired it up, kept driving.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Okay, I want one now.
Yep.
I don't have a lot of beaches nearby, but I still like the idea. Especially $10,000 to $20,000, really?
That's the idea. I mean, yes, in a lot of other countries.
Wow.
Yeah, for sure.
Nice.
They produce it very cheaply. But a lot of that reason is there are safety standards and emission standards in the U.S. that they don't have to contend with other places. So the question is, how can we bring it here without it being encumbered by all that stuff?
And that just really emphasizes the whole trade war problem, right?
Yep.
Because even if you did bring it here, you now have to increase all that compliance cost, and now you have problems.
Yep.
Ugh. So you got to deal with the compliance cost question.
Or you could register it as an off-road only vehicle, like a side by side.
Yeah, yeah. Ooh.
And then you just couldn't drive it on the road technically. I see people driving side by sides on the road around here all the time.
It's like a ghost gun at that point.
Yeah, exactly. All right, back on topic.
So yeah. Anyway, so this is I think if the Trump administration is going to hold together its coalition and to really build this, they got to keep giving the gun guys something. Right. So this is it's been a while. I mean, we're 4 months in political terms, it's not bad. But in terms of like compared to what he's given everybody else and pro-life and all these other areas, this is a huge, huge hopeful pivot point where they can keep going and do more in the gun space to appease that demographic. Because if they want to win politically, they need those guys.
For sure.
100%.
It's a big lobby.
Yeah. Well, and it's a lot of voters, too. A lot of people are just motivated by that. They love their guns.
Yeah.
Right? It's an American institution.
Yeah, I should say a big constituency.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
For sure.
Yeah. So, that's it.
There it is.
Yeah.
That's the news for the week.
If you want more, go to the Discord. We're debating right now just war theory from the Christian point of view. And like how much are we deviating from the Christian, from the New Testament in the words of Jesus when people are talking about just war theory? Because there was this interesting tweet from... Seth, whatever, Dylan, the guy from
Babylon B,
about that, where he's drawing Thomas Aquinas and like, well, that's not the New Testament. We're going into it. So it's going to be fun. So
nice. Jump
into the Discord, get in there with us. Even if you don't care about that, if you just care about guns, let us know other gun stories that we should be covering because we're not doing a good enough job and we need more of it.
That's right. We need your feedback. We need your input. What do you want to hear from us? Join the Discord. Link's in the description below. Thanks so much for tuning in today. On behalf of David Rand and the rest of the Human Reaction team, I'm Joe Sheehan. We'll see you in the next one. Thanks for tuning in to Human Reaction. Please be sure to like, follow, subscribe, and give us a review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you want to become a member and support the show financially, check out humanreactionpod.com. And remember...
Don't tell me my happiness.
All right. Yeah.
Maybe
don't
I
tell
do.
Me what I need.